Good evening, James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for May 12th, 2022, and just a reminder, about a month ago, it was for the April 14th show in this ongoing series of discoveries of my work. I'm taking the entire year of my radio show for 2022, and I'm picking apart year by year, event by event, the history of my discoveries. This is not a summary. There's somewhat of a summary of my discoveries, etc. But also, do not make the mistake of thinking that you're going to learn what my work says. You have to read my books, and I have, for example, my education package, which goes into a lot of detail on the specifics of my discoveries. This is a history of my discoveries and a lot of events surrounding it. But going back 1 month, I want to remind you, if you did not do this, make a note of it. The April 14th show, there was an emergency international event that turned up, and I had to dedicate my show that week, the live show, to this event. And it's if you look on my webpage for the archives, jmccsci.com, and go just look at the top, go down a little bit in the list at the top, and you'll see radio show. Click on that and go to April 14th and listen to the main show. There's one called Substitute. That's the one I did on that topic. But you have the April 14th show did not air on shortwave or on any of the other venues, seven other venues where this show airs. So the only place you're going to get that, and it's a very important show in this sequence, so go back and listen to that. April 14th, once again, just go to jmccsci.com. Go scroll down to April 14th and listen to the regular show. Very important. It'll take an hour of your time, but it's I did not want to interrupt the sequence of these shows in juxtaposition 1 week. So that's the way I'm dealing with this. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And by the way, the topics I covered on that April 14th show were, where does the term electric universe come from? I go through the history of that, show how it appeared in my publication, and now you have little groups running around the internet, jumping up and down, saying electric universe, thinking they solved all the problems in the world. And so anyway, I want to show you where that term actually came from. And then I talk about a guy who I met at Cornell, Stan Dermott, one of the honest, good scientists that was there. I like to give credit where credit is due. Then I also talk about the last weeks at Cornell and the confrontation that I had on campus. I also talk about the secure positions that I got after leaving Cornell, went up to Canada for 10 months to purify my body and spirit. And then I came back and I got a very high-level job using my physics and mathematics background in the telecommunications industry. I talk about that. A few more incidents regarding Canada. So anyway, it's a very good show, and I suggest that you listen to it. Like I say, go back to jmccsci.com, look at the top, look at the list there, and find radio show. Click on that. Go down to the April 14th show. There will be two shows posted. One is the substitute show, and which eventually I'll probably just take out of there because it's not historically important. But then there's the show that should have been aired on April 14th. Okay, so and I just, like I say, I did not want to change the order of things. So go and do that. Make sure you make a note to listen to that April 14th show. Every one of these shows is packed with information on the historical development of my work. Okay, so tonight's show, I will be talking about the 1980s, the early to mid-1980s. It was a very active time for me. You would think that after being trounced and bounced out of Cornell, that I would just have gone away. And a lot of independent scientists got their careers destroyed. I saw them falling one at a time, and very good scientists, but the dominant NASA scientists who got the data, these other people like me could not get data, and so they went by the wayside, but I was not an easy fare, because I knew I was on top of what was really going on here. Okay, so just to mention, 1980 is a very active time. In fact, there's not a dull moment up to the present, which continues. I was invited to Los Alamos. I'm going to go into that tonight. A very interesting set of circumstances where I'm invited to Los Alamos to lecture the top 50 plasma physicists, scientists in the world, located at Los Alamos, on my work. And the way that came down, and you can see me actually on my DVD set as a very young person. And now they filmed this there. They filmed the meeting, but I was not allowed myself to film it. So what I did is when I got done, I went back and I reproduced my talk, basically. And that's what the video is of. It's at the same suit I wore, everything. But I'll tell you just a little funny story, a little anecdote that goes along with this visit to Los Alamos. So I'm invited, I go out there, and I have a period of time to be with the physics groups at Los Alamos. And of course, these are all tier one scientists. And I go in, and my talk was in the afternoon, like probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Or 1 o'clock. It was like early in the afternoon, and the morning I spent with the high energy bomb group, and so these are guys that could hardly speak English. World War II carryovers, clearly, with the real big baggy pants. They were still wearing the clothes that you would have worn in World War II, the felt pants. Oh my goodness, this was like stepping back in time. And so not many young people there. These were groups, and what they were doing that day is they were doing depth calculations on high altitude bombs and the radiation patterns, because the radiation patterns would create not only the explosion, but the radiation patterns would cause people to die if there were a nuclear war. So they were doing these calculations, which, by the way, I later used these same techniques when we were doing depth calculations regarding hurricanes, manipulated hurricanes in Florida and Katrina, etc., because the statistics are very much the same. So they were doing mathematical statistics, depth calculations based on nuclear bombs. This is where I am, and here I am, a conscientious objector, a person who does not believe in nuclear war or war in general. And this is who I'm with. And so then we go to lunch, and then my talk is in the afternoon. So we sit down, and it was going to be a one-hour talk. It lasted 4 hours. And at first, when I first started giving the talk, there were some kind of wise guys, and you could tell, like I've told you before, there's always in these groups a big mouth, a wise guy. What about this? I said, I'm getting to that. I knew how to handle crowds because I had been in front of these types of crowds many times up to this point. This is about probably around 1986 time frame. And I said, well, I'm getting to that. And by the time the 4 hours were done, I looked out into the audience, and these guys were all slumped down in their chairs, staring at the board with their mouths hanging open. And, you know, and I had this crowd of 50 top plasma physicists in the world worn out. So I went through all of my work, and they were just amazed. I mean, it was a lesson. I took them, to the lesson, let's put it that way, of my work. And I could tell that these people were blown away. I mean, they were walking out of that room like they'd just been run a 25-kilometer marathon mentally. There was no smart, wise guys at the end of that. But here's something also. I went with a girlfriend, and of course she couldn't go to Los Alamos, so she went out shopping or whatever that day. And I went back, and she had purchased a bottle of champagne and rented the movie Dr. Strangelove. Now, I get done with this talk, and I'm in literally Dr. Strangelove, you know, Los Alamos National Laboratories. I mean, it was so fitting. So we sat down, drank a little champagne, and watched the movie Doctor Strangelove. Mind-tingling event that whole day. And I was worn out, too. I mean, it's very taxing when you're on a show like, say, Coast to Coast, and you're doing 3 hours of intensive show. And it's, you got to be really on your toes because you don't know what's going to come at you, what questions, what kind of conversation, if there would be callers calling in, etc. So you got to be on your toes. But this was probably the most, I wouldn't say it was the most tuned, most educated group I was in front of. I was also in some of these military groups for the International Electric Propulsion Conference. And there you had 200 top physicists from the military in a meeting, and I'm up in front of these people talking to them, describing my work. And I also want to reiterate here that sometimes people associate me, for example, with the plasma discharge comet model or something like that. The work extends over the origin of galaxies, the solar wind, solar physics, magnetosphere of the sun, solar corona, and many, many other topics that deal with, for example, the formation of planets in the Kuiper Belt. How does that happen? Why is there water on planet Earth? Weather, the manipulation of weather. And so the span of my work covers so many different topics. And the little groups running around trying to copy what I'm doing just can only barely copy a little piece of it, and then they twist it into something goofy. And those people wouldn't last 2 minutes in front of a real group of physicists. So they run around, have their own little meetings, and they talk to each other. But nobody pays any attention to them. And that's the whole point of controlled opposition. So that, in fact, I'll mention this again, that YouTube, I was the original banned person on YouTube. Back in the early days when YouTube first came out, I was not allowed, or if somebody, a fan or somebody, a person, made a comment in the blog using my name or webpage, it was immediately removed. So the algorithms to censor people were in place way back then. But I was the first one to be censored. And the reason you're censored is because you're, you know, as they say, you get the most flack when you're over the target. Oh, and just something occurred to me when I walked into the room. First of all, this meeting at Los Alamos was set up by a group of physicists that worked between Goddard and Los Alamos, and that's common. They'll be positioned both at, say, one of JPL or whatever, but they were resident at Los Alamos, and these were the high-energy plasma physics groups who dealt with outer space, etc., and they are the ones that set up my invitation. But anyway, a rather comical event. When they set up the talk, they had all the cameras and all of the equipment set up in one room, and it was a rather small room. And when the people showed up, there was probably room for maybe 20 people in the room that they had designated. About 50 people showed up, so clearly they had to do something. So they got a bigger room and moved over there, and they moved some of the equipment over, but they couldn't move all of the equipment over. But as the people were filing into the room, one guy blurts out, he goes, "Is this where the snowball fight is?" Referring, of course, to the dirty snowball comet model. So they very much knew why I was there, and of course, these are people who probably had many published papers dealing with dirty snowball comet model. So I was walking into somewhat of a hornet's nest here, but let me tell you also that if I were not completely on my toes and had the presence to talk to this kind of a group, then I wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in there. And like I say, as it turned out, it was an hour-long talk planned. It ended up being 4 hours, including the question and answer period. And these people were drained. They were like worn out by the end of the day. So anyway, that's a very interesting experience. And like I say, the people who invited me to this were physicists that worked at Los Alamos in the dealing with the satellites that were dealing, you know, data from comets. And so even though they may not have had their own probes, they had the ISW3, and then also they had the, which was, and these are a combination when you see a satellite like that, say under the guidance of Goddard, the people at Los Alamos and other JPL, et cetera, are involved also. And they pick a team and they go with it. So these are people that were very, very versed in what was going on in the world of comets, according to Dirty Snowball Comet Model Theory. So I had to overcome that and then present my own material on top of that. Okay, now I'm going to change gears a little bit. There's a term called Chapman physics. And interestingly enough, before recording this, I went out to search for this, and there's really not a lot of reference to this. And I'm just wondering if they're just trying to slide this out of the scene. But the thing that triggered my memory is a week ago, I get a newsletter from the American Geophysical Union meeting. And one of the newsletters is dealing with solar magnetic physics. And I've been receiving these for, you know, decades and decades. But anyway, what I do is I look at the titles of the talks and the presentations that are coming up, and there might be a planned session where these people fly around. And I call it scientific vacations, because these people in their grant money get a lot of money for travel. And, of course, when I went to Los Alamos, they paid my way, my room and board, etc. But a lot of times when I go to, say, American Geophysical Union meetings or general meetings, then I pay my own way, which is fine. You know, that's okay. Being an independent scientist, that's part of life in the big city. But anyway, there was a line item in the recent SPA, it's called. It's the Solar Physics and Atmosphere sessions that I've taken part in many of these over the years. But it talked about the Chapman physics and Alphen waves. And so for those of you who do not know, Hans Alphen was a physicist from Europe, from Northern Europe, and he won a Nobel Prize for his work on what they call Alphen waves. And these are waves that are measured with satellites, etc. And anyway, I want to read something here, because a lot of people put a lot of credence in what he did. And he did some very good work. He was one of the pioneers. He dealt with the currents, for example, with auroras and earth-based magnetic field currents, electric currents that you can see. I mean, the auroras are definitely electrical currents. But I want to read what he himself said, which is telling. And so anyway, also along with this, there's something called double layers. And double layers are typically found in laboratory situations where charged layers on top of a physical body have a secondary layer of charge, and they're basically a capacitor is what they are. A double layer is a capacitor. But they're small. They're molecular level sizes. They're distances that these double layers live in is very small. It's down at the molecular size. It's not something that's visible in outer space. And I want to mention that when I developed my plasma discharge comet model, there are no double layers in this model at all. And the reason is these are very high energy discharges. And the discharge is of a capacitor that is very large, built up by the excess current of protons in the solar wind. It's from the sun out to this huge nebular ion cloud past the orbit of Pluto. So these are not double layers. They're not anything related to double layers. But I want to read what Hans Alphen himself said. Okay, so here we go. This is a quote from Hans Alphen himself, Nobel Prize winner. Okay, so here's what he said. In a low-density plasma, which is the case in outer space, by the way, so he says, in a low-density plasma, localized space charge regions may build up large potential drops over distances of the order of some tens of the Debye lengths. That's dealing with shielding. Okay, then he says, such regions have been called electric double layers. An electric double layer is the simplest space charge distribution. It gives a potential drop in the layer and a vanishing electric field on each side of the layer. In the laboratory, double layers have been studied for half a century, but their importance in the cosmic plasma has not been generally recognized. So there are people running around talking about double layers, and they literally do not apply it because, for example, around a comet, what you have is the green halo, which you can physically see with your eye. It's perfectly spherical. Nobody in the dirty snowball comet model world can tell you why there's this blue-green capacitor with ionized gases in it, typically hydrogen and carbon, etc. But the plasma discharge comet model is perfectly clear. This is a Debye shielding. In other words, it's a space charge sheath that surrounds the nucleus because the nucleus is negatively charged. So you have ionized hydrogen, you have ionized carbon, and they form a big region of space surrounding the comet nucleus. And you can see it with the naked eye. On big comets, you can see this. It's very visible, and certainly in photos after photo after photo. And it's a green line, and there is speculation that it's due to carbon. But if you look at the hydrogen green line, it's the same color. I mean, your eye can see that it's the same color, unless you're colorblind. But the point is that double layers are very, very thin. There are a couple of molecular layers thick. And as Hans Alphen himself, the person that won a Nobel Prize for discussing electrical currents, things like auroras around Earth. And so what I'm going to do here is I'm going to actually read the 1970 Nobel Prize in Physics. It goes to Hans Alphen and another gentleman for fundamental work and discoveries in magnetohydrodynamics with fruitful applications in different parts of plasma physics. And, okay, so now the work, I'm going to describe this, and then I'm going to do some commentary on it, because it's very important to put this into perspective of what he did. And he was very advanced at the time, but he was still missing the point. They did not understand that there was an energy source out there. And fundamental to this, and I'm going to be talking about Chapman physics here in a minute, which fundamentally states that there can be no electric charge in outer space, any free charge, let's put it that way. Of course, there are charged particles in plasma, but they're neutralized. If you look at a distance, it's a neutral plasma. And so there again, Hans Alphen, although he was advanced at the time he did his work in the 30s and 40s and 50s and the 60s, finally in 1970 gets the Nobel Prize. Here is what it says. And I'm going to comment on this term. Just remember the term magnetohydrodynamics, because it turns out that it really does not work. To explain, it's a good first attempt, but it does not explain what we're really seeing because they don't have an energy source. And that's what I discovered was the energy source in the fusion of the sun. And all of these are laboring under the false assertion that the energy source of the sun is in its core. And that is not correct. They're still laboring under this false assertion. And so anyway, the Nobel Prize, and like I say, and this was good for the time, but it did not answer the question, where does the energy come from? Hello? First thing you have to do in anything physics, you have to determine the energy source. And if you don't have one, you do not have a theory. Okay, so here's the Nobel Prize for Physics 1970, Hans Olof Gustav Alphen. The phenomena of aurora borealis occurs when bursts of charged particles from the sun collide with the Earth's magnetic field. Well, they're not. They're being guided by the magnetic field, and they collide with the upper Earth's atmosphere. Okay, so anyway, I'll read this again. The phenomena of aurora borealis occurs when bursts of charged particles from the sun collide with the Earth's magnetic field. These jets of particles are an example of a spatial state of matter called plasma. Plasma is a gas comprised of electrons and ions, electrically charged atoms
that form at high temperatures. From the late 1930s onwards, Hans Alfvén developed a theory for aurora borealis. That's the northern lights, if you're not familiar with that term. Which led to magnetohydrodynamics, the theory of the relationship between the plasma's movement, electric currents and fields, and magnetic fields. Okay, so you see, they're laboring under the false assumption that all of these things just happen, that there are just magnetic fields, that there are just electric currents, and they just are there. And it's an observation, but like I say, they don't have the source of energy. And in my training in physics, all the way through physics, and I learned these lessons very well. You have conservation of momentum, conservation of energy, entropy. You have all of the other physical properties of a system. But you have to understand that the number one, numero uno, the first thing that you have to discover is, where's the energy source for all of this activity? You have high energy particles. Where did they get to be high energy? What made them accelerate? Do they just happen to exist in outer space? Where do they come from? How does the sun pump out these high energy particles? And they were beginning to understand the solar wind at these points in time. But it's like Tesla. There's another good example. Now, I talked about Tesla previously, but I'll be talking a lot more about Tesla when we get up into the early 2000s. But Tesla did some experiments at the Wardenclyffe, at the Colorado Springs experimental station, and he was gathering atmospheric electricity, and then he was tunneling it underground, converting it to a known frequency that was any kind of resisting medium that has capacitance, inductance, and resistance. There is a optimal frequency that you can transmit the electricity through this medium. And the ground has such a optimal frequency. And he knew that. He knew what it was. That's what he was doing at Wardenclyffe. He was gathering atmospheric electricity, and then the plan was to send it into the ground. And what you read in the popular press today about Tesla is all backwards. They're saying that he was going to transmit energy with his tower. Well, where was he supposed to get the energy from? He already sold all his generating equipment to Westinghouse and signed a non-disclosure agreement and a non-compete agreement that he could not compete against using this same technology, which would be standard practice. And he got paid $5 million. I don't know why he ended up a pauper. Well, I do. He invested his money in research and ended up a pauper living in a hotel room in New York City. And so, anyway, the end result was that Tesla did not know where the energy came from. He knew how to tap into it. He knew it was there. He knew the vertical electric field was there. But he didn't know where that energy came from, and that's what I discovered. That was one of the major, major points, is understanding. And then here you have Hans Alfvén winning the Nobel Prize 1970 for something called magnetohydrodynamics. Now, I was at a meeting, this is very interesting and telling, American Geophysical Union meeting, and I came in, and for some reason the meeting had been scrapped. And there were two physicists that were solar plasma physicists, and I don't remember their association or where they were from. But they were talking, and I overheard them talking, and they were talking about magnetohydrodynamics. And they were going, under their breath, they were saying, you know, it doesn't work. This doesn't explain anything. And they knew who I was, and I just commented. I said, no, it doesn't work, because it doesn't explain where the energy source was. And they told me, said, yeah, it doesn't work. But this getting back to the newsletter that I received recently from the American Geophysical Union meeting, and it said the meeting they were talking about people signing up and going to was called Chapman Physics and Hans Alfvén and Alfvén Waves. And it's like a contradiction. When I talk about Chapman Physics, you will understand also why it's a total contradiction. So Hans Alfvén created a theme called magnetohydrodynamics, and it's been followed because There's no reason in that mindset, in that thinking, for an energy source. It just exists. Electric currents exist, magnetic fields exist, they just are there. What I did is I discovered that, number one, the nuclear fusion is up in the atmosphere of the sun. And there's not enough atmosphere there to keep going very long, so it has to be renewed. So the sun is acting as a comet. It's drawing in hydrogen from the intergalactic medium, and that's keeping the sun fueled at the current rate. And this is ongoing. But this is the source of energy for all our weather on Earth. The idea that our weather is caused by solar light coming into our atmosphere and that somehow heats it up, and that's the cause of all our weather, is just absolutely absurd. That couldn't possibly be true. If we had only that for our source of weather, power, energy, then we would have extremely bland weather on Earth. There would be no clouds. There would be no hurricanes or tornadoes. There would be no wind. Nothing. All of this is powered by the electric field of the sun that is created by the excess current of protons in the solar wind. So that is so fundamental to the understanding of comets, also fundamental to understanding weather on Earth, on Jupiter. Jupiter has its own fusion process, but a lot of its weather also comes from the discharge of the solar capacitor. I remember, it's probably about 20 years ago, the military had satellites up and they saw this tremendous electron current coming to Earth from Jupiter. Earth was connecting into the sunward electron stream coming out of the sun to Jupiter, and Earth was connecting into that. And they didn't know where it was coming from. This is the military. This is supposedly Tier 1 military science. Okay, sorry, my voice is a little weak today. I've been having this cold issue. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about Chapman physics. Now, what is Chapman physics? And this started back in the early 1900s, this theme. It came to be known as Chapman physics, and it dominated. And there was this is why I'm saying this is interesting, that the Chapman physics session of the American Physical Union is having a session on alpha waves, because Chapman said the following. He said there are no free electric charges in outer space, and there is good reason for understanding this, and I'm going to explain it. Then I'm going to explain the error that they made. Okay, and there again, it comes back to the basic idea, concept, that the core fusion model of the sun, that the fusion of the sun is in the core, and that's simply not correct. It's totally incorrect. When I worked with Russian scientists in the 1980s, these guys were very creative because they didn't have the best equipment, et cetera, but they had a lot of creativity, so they could do very complex experiments with very simple equipment. And so anyway, what they did is they took an X-ray detector, and I described this, I believe it's in my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, and they scanned with an X-ray detector, and they could get the spectrum of the X-rays, and they scanned across the entire surface of the sun, like going through the scanning across the center part of the sun. And so what they did is, when they started scanning in from the left side, as they moved across, they would subtract off the X-rays that were coming from the surface, because they had just measured only the surface coming in from the left side. And then they would keep subtracting off and subtracting off what had previously been measured. And so all they were getting was the measurement of X-rays from deeper and deeper in the atmosphere of the sun, until they got down, and all of a sudden it just flatlined all the way across the center, and then it picked up, and then it reversed on the way back out. And what they saw was that the X-rays coming from the core of the sun were cooler. It was much cooler than the atmosphere, which told them that the physics of the fusion was up in the atmosphere, and proving my theoretical work, and that's why they did it, because my theoretical work told them that the fusion process was in the atmosphere, not in the core. And they proved it. This is 20 years ago. This is 18 years ago? Something like that, that they did this experiment, and the world is still laboring under the idea that the fusion in the sun is at the core. So the Chapman physics essentially is making that assumption, and there should be no solar wind, there should be nothing, there should be no surface granularity, there should be no magnetic fields on the sun if the fusion is at the core, because it's simply heat coming out. There's no reason for any electromagnetic phenomena at all, but there is. And that's because the fusion in the surface of is in the upper atmosphere. And then that explains the corona. All of the things follow from this model. My work on the atmospheric fusion of the sun, and of course that comes from Jupiter and Saturn also, from the Voyager probes that showed that Jupiter and Saturn are small stars. They have a proton wind coming up off their surface, measured by those satellites. Okay, so at any rate, Chapman physics states that there can be no free charge in outer space. And the reason, which is a very good reason, theoretically, is that the free plasma in outer space, of which there's a lot, would quickly move to neutralize that charge. Okay, well, that would be true if there were not a charge separating cell in the center called the sun. And so what the sun does, what the fusion process up in the atmosphere, what it does is it separates charge. It separates the electrons from the protons, sends the protons out, and I've talked about this before, how it's similar to a Van de Graaff generator, where you take electrons and you keep putting them on this electric circuit, and they flow out to the outer bell because they're repelling each other, and they build up and they build up and they build up. So a Van de Graaff is a very good example of the same way the solar wind works. So you end up with a capacitor, and the planets, the comets, meteors, everything is discharging this solar capacitor. Some of them on a very local basis, like Earth would be on a very local basis. We're not discharging all the way out to the outer nebular ion cloud. We're just having a local discharge. But that is the source of energy for what Tesla was doing, for what Hans Alfen was doing. And that's the plasma energy source for the plasma discharge comet model. And it takes a lot of energy to build a planet. And so that energy comes from this same physical capacitor. And for example, when Hale-Bopp was being born as a planet and gaining a tremendous amount of mass and growing in size, it took a lot of energy out of the sun. And so it's like having a baby. And a mother loses a lot of energy. It's a very taxing experience. Having a planet form in the solar system is a very taxing experience also, because it takes a lot of energy out of the solar capacitor, and that is why the Earth's level of solar maximums has gone down tremendously since the year 2000, when Hale-Bopp was current in the central solar system, and now it's building back up. It's getting back to normal now. But the whole idea of Chapman physics is incorrect, because the way a comet continues to charge is by discharging the solar capacitor. The primary charge carrier is in the electrons coming out from the sun, and they hit the comet nucleus region. They slow down, and that's where the Bremsstrahlung X-rays come from on the northern, on the nose side of the comet, on the sunward side of the comet. That's where the X-rays come from. And then there's a buildup of space charge around the comet nucleus, which is negative. So that draws in the plus ions coming in and building up on the surface of the nucleus, and the big comets have enough mass to maintain the infalling material. The little comets don't. And so they don't really build up. They don't become bigger. And there's kind of a critical size that comet nuclei with enough mass will build up matter and continue building up until they become planets. Okay, switching gears here. There's a paper that I wrote that became part of an American Geophysical Union meeting notes. In all of these, in fact, this is available on the public. It's called Dynamics of a Small Comet. And the paper was designed, now here's what happened. There was a group of physicists at Goddard. And also when I say Goddard, this included the high energy plasma group at Los Alamos. And by the way, that's why these people knew me. I mean, I was working in this field. I was active in this field. And they knew that I was the top person in this field because what I was saying was absolutely correct. But there was a spacecraft called ISWE-3, which was a solar monitoring spacecraft, which was, there were a number of these. There was the ISWE-1, 2, and then 3. And they had, I think they ran for about 10 years, and they would move out through the bow shock region of Earth and come back through, and they would just study the plasmas that existed in these regions, and they really produced a lot of physics. I got to know some of the people on the staff, and the James Farquhar was the head of this effort, and the ISWE-3 satellite was dying. I mean, its batteries were running out. It was aging. And so he got together with some people, I believe they were from JPL, I think Farquhar was from Goddard, and said, hey, can we get this thing out to this comet, or to a comet? And said they put together a package that was very creative, where they took and they swung it around Venus. They were able to maneuver this satellite so it would go by Venus, swing around Venus, and get a catapult effect, a slingshot effect, as they call it, and send it out and direct it towards this comet. And they went right through the tail region of the comet. And I told them go through the nose side because that's where they would see the electron beam and the X-rays. So as a result of this, I wrote a paper called Dynamics of a Small Comet. And so what I'm going to do now is break that paper down and talk about it. And once again, this is the mid-1980s before the French and the Japanese and other entities went to Halley's Comet. And just by the way, you can see this paper. It's in the appendix of my Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection book. And so it gives you a flavor of what was going on. This, once again, is the mid-1980s. Give you the time frame when this paper and why it was written, and it was to specifically discuss the plasma physics of going through the tail of a comet. Now, this is a spacecraft that did not have any cameras, and I'll just give you a little anecdote here to begin with. I may have talked about this before, but I'll repeat it because now we're in the time frame for this paper. This, when this paper was actually going out there and being seen by physicists. Okay, so I get wind of this. I hear that they're going to take this spacecraft, they're going to divert it and go out to this comet. And so I called up. The other thing I saw was that they were going to turn off some of the equipment on the spacecraft to save energy, to save on the batteries, because the batteries, they were going to be farther away from the sun than its normal positioning. And so they had to conserve battery power. Otherwise, the whole trip could be a failure if they ran out of battery power just so, as they were getting to the comet. So they decided to turn off. They turned around and asked JPL scientists, the comet scientists, showing them the list of packages, the payload packages, or the instrumentation on the spacecraft. And the JPL comes back and says, well, you don't need the X-ray detector, so turn it off. And when I heard this, I'm like, whoa, that's the most important thing here. Because this would prove exactly what I'm saying. Because if comets have X-rays, then it certainly ain't no snowball. And so I called up the principal investigators on the mission. And I said, hey, you guys are going to a party, but you're not invited. You know, it's like you're being left out and you have the most important thing. And, you know, the X-ray detector. and they, you should leave that on. And of course, they did not feel good about this because they were going to a party and, you know, basically left outside. So I called up James Farquhar and I told him, and he said, well, the experts at NASA tell us that we don't need the X-ray detector because there would not be any X-rays at a comet. Well, it was about 10 years later when they accidentally discovered that all comets have X-rays, not only some X-rays, but a very big signature of X-rays. So this would have been discovered and would have matched my prediction, which I had made, you know, many years earlier in my the work dealing with the three-part comet paper that I've already described. But they turned off the X-ray detector. They fly through the comet, and like I say, the X-rays in comets would have been discovered in this 1985 time frame with this ISWE-3 spacecraft going to Comet Giacobini-Zinner. And also, I met some of the people on this as I went to American Geophysical Union meetings. Tycho von Rosenvinge was one of the lead scientists on this, and I had lunch with him. I've already talked about the lunch I had with him and Jonathan Everhart in a sushi bar in San Francisco to discuss these findings. And that's when the whole issue with Jonathan Everhart publishing an article about my work being slam dunked for mentioning my name in a favorable manner. But I mean, this has followed me throughout my whole career. You know, the people are very interested in it. They see what I'm doing, and then they just get shut down from inside. Okay, so anyway, Dynamics of a Small Comet, the paper. And so what I'll do is pick this apart piece by piece here. Oh, there's one little item I forgot to mention about the ISWE-3 satellite, and that's what this is all about, is that trip to Giacobini-Zinner. They changed the name, interestingly enough, because it's IC-3 is the way it sounds, but it's spelt ISWE-3, and the 3 being a 1, like a Roman numeral 3. But they changed it to ICE-3, in anticipation of an ice ball comet model, because this was the anticipation. They turned the X-ray detector off because they did not expect X-rays. And so clearly the complete belief here, I mean the saturated belief here, was that comets were dirty snowballs. No one in their wildest dreams imagined. And of course, my work got snuffed. I mean, that's the best term you can take. The scientific community hierarchy at Cornell made sure my work did not reach anybody, etc. It, you know, was not in the publication. And these people live off publications. It's tier two science. They live and breathe through publications and maybe something that'll filter down into something like Scientific American, maybe, but primarily it's through journals. And that's where it is anticipated that everything is right and correct and verified and refereed, the peer-reviewed, they even call them the respectable peer-reviewed journals, giving you the impression of all correctness and grandeur and glory, etc. But so anyway, that little anecdote that they changed the name of the satellite from ISWE-3 to ICE or ICE-3, anticipating an ice ball comet model. Okay, so on with the paper. Okay, so this is once again looking, this is reprinted in the appendix of my Atlantis to Tesla, the Colburn Connection book. Dynamics of a Small Comet, copyright 1986, to give you the time frame. So this is right after the Giacobini-Zinner fly-through of with the ISWE-3 satellite. And the first note here in the book, it says, note, this paper, as with many of my other papers, was submitted to standard peer-reviewed journals, but by this time my work was blackballed at all levels. This paper, as with many others, was returned without ever sending to a referee and without comment. So that even here you can see in 1987, the blackball of my name and my work was very much in place. Okay, so the abstract, I'm just going to quickly read it because it really sets the tone for what's going on. Previous papers discussed the existence of an excess current of protons in the solar wind. This excess current of positive charge leaves the sun with the net negative charge, forming a capacitor between the sun and rings which have been detected orbiting the sun, analogous to the rings of Saturn. The physics of the solar Saturnian systems and their capacitors are described in detail in the previous published series of papers. The solar capacitor can be discharged when an asteroid body enters the region between rings or between the ring and the sun. The visual portion of this discharge is commonly referred to as a comet. The majority of activity in this cometary discharge, however, is not visible to the naked eye or telescope. And this is, once again, predating the idea of X-rays and all kinds of other phenomena. Okay, reading on. The earlier papers developed concepts which could be derived using celestial mechanics, electromagnetic theory, plasma physics, and available space probe data. From the initial look at detail recently obtained by the Goddard Space Flight Center's ISWE-3 satellite at Comet Giacobini-Zinner, a more complete picture of the internal activity of the cometary discharge has been evaluated. This refined understanding of the comet, of the small cometary discharge, is the topic of the present paper. The dynamics of larger, more energetic comets are treated in other papers. So this is talking about a small comet. And the first thing I do is I set out the primary results concerning the discharge of the solar capacitor include the following. Electrons, due to their higher mobility, are the primary charge carriers in the discharge. These are collected by the asteroidal obstruction, the asteroidal object, causing a buildup of negative charge on the comet nucleus. Positively ionized atoms, molecules, and dust particles form the tail and are attracted towards the comet nucleus. They are not melting away as specified in the ice ball comet model. Notice it's called the ice ball comet model back in 1985-86. And number four, the comet tail shape is formed as ions and dust particles stream into the comet nucleus following the electric field lines of the negatively charged sun and comet nucleus. So it's the combined electric fields of the sun and comet nucleus that gives the comet its shape, as discussed in my three-part comet paper a number of weeks ago. Then it says, the myriad of effects observable in comets are readily explained in terms of this model. Okay, then I go through on the physics, etc., that the things that we learned here are the extent of the local electric field of the comet nucleus, the current levels which are passed in the cometary discharge, the dynamics of electron flow around the nucleus, etc. The details of this are best given in examples in figures 1 and 2. So I encourage you to go get my book, Atlantis to Tesla, the Copeland Connection, where you can see these diagrams because they're too complicated to describe verbally. And figure 1 shows the overall cometary discharge and the interaction of the solar wind with the local electric field. And figure 2 details what the ISWE-3 satellite experienced during its transit of Comet Giacobini-Zinner. It is figure 2 that should be examined closely in light of available data. Okay, so then there's the photos. And let me just go down to the second photo because that's exactly what the spacecraft is going to experience. And I show the path that it follows behind the comet nucleus. Now this, for them to come and get to this comet and go exactly right behind the comet nucleus was a feat, absolutely amazing, amazing work that was done by the JPL. This was a combination of the JPL people, and these are techies. These are the people that make stuff work out there. And, you know, I give a lot of grief to NASA and Cornell and the NASA scientists and JPL and Goddard. But those are the scientists, the techies, the engineers that make all this stuff work are the real unsung heroes of the space program. I'll make no bones about stating that specifically. Okay, so the spacecraft comes in. It's in the interplanetary medium, the solar wind. All of a sudden, it starts to encounter the electric field of the comet. And so, also, it'll start to detect its magnetic field on a very small scale. And because of the electron current, magnetic field will be in a very specific direction because they are hitting into and towards the electrical discharge. Now, the electrical discharge comes from the sun out to the comet nucleus. It sprays around the comet nucleus because the electrons, there's a concentration of negative charge at the nucleus of the comet. So the electron stream sprays around it and then rejoins after it gets past the comet nucleus and then continues on for probably 3 million miles or more, maybe up to 10 million miles. Where this discharge, and so that's the part of the discharge you cannot see. The only thing you can really detect there is if you had an X-ray detector, it would be on the front side of the sunward side of the comet nucleus. As the electrons start to encounter the material being drawn in by the comet, that starts to the electrons also start to detect the electric field. And slow down as they're spreading out and spreading around. They're slowing down. So the best example is like a rock in a river. If you take a big rock and put it in a river, it's going to have a lot of pressure on the forward side. It's a flow problem. It's the very same thing as any kind of flow problem, except here you have charged electrons, which makes it much more dynamic because the electrons repel each other. And so once that charge starts building up, the electrons are going to try and flow around it. But the overall discharge continues because this is just a little impediment in the middle of the discharge. So we're running out of time here. I'll probably just continue this next week because it's so important. I also have next week, I'll be talking about Halley's Comet and the many spacecraft that went out. And some very interesting stories regarding that whole era where NASA had literally mud on their face as the Giotto spacecraft, which had a camera, got right into the comet nucleus. They were expecting this bright white snowball, and as they broke through the final layer, it turned out to be the blackest object ever seen in the solar system. So I'll be back next week to talk more about that. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.